Welcome back, everyone. We will now proceed with the second portion of United States v. Hassan. Mr. Potter, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Emmons, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Mr. Potter, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Earlier, Major Osterhage described how the Army Court was conflicted in this case and also described how this court's opinion in Dock affected appellant's court-martial. I'm going to talk this morning about two errors committed by the military judge. First, I will discuss the military judge's error in totally closing appellant's court-martial. Second, I will discuss the military judge's error in seating a biased panel member. The military judge committed structural error when she totally closed appellant's court-martial. She did so before making any findings and conducting any analysis pursuant to Waller. And she did so over appellant's objection. The closed proceedings involved the improper disclosure of attorney-client matters by standby counsel to the prosecution and also involved appellant's claim that standby counsel were interfering with appellant's case, ultimately violating his Faretta rights and the remedy for such a violation. As the Sixth Circuit said in NBC, a case involving a similar ethical claim, there is a significant positive role in having such proceedings open, and the resolution of the claim would have had a significant bearing on all subsequent proceedings in the case. There is an additional positive in that the public can see an accused ethical claim is being dealt with fairly. As such, the hearing was the type of hearing that must be open pursuant to the Sixth Amendment.
Mr. Potter, do any of the authorities, I'm genuinely asking, I have some good law clerks, but I was wondering, do any of the authorities you've come across have the same situation you have here where the appellant is proceeding pro se and this issue arises?
Your Honor, I have not found such a case.
Would you agree with me that in looking at the military judge's decision here to do that, at least from her perspective, she kind of was in a tough spot? Or do you not agree that she didn't know really what the accused might say that would fall outside the privilege concerns? And so she decided to make the decision to find out what the accused wanted or didn't want in a closed session. Do you agree with that characterization? You don't have to, but I mean...
No, Your Honor, I don't, because the presumption is openness, and that was her first error. She presumed she could just close the court. The presumption is always openness. And she just closed the court. She didn't make the appropriate analysis whatsoever. She just says, I'm closing the court. And then she ordered all the spectators, all the security, and even the court security out of the courtroom. She made no Waller findings whatsoever before she closed the court. She didn't even say exactly why she was closing the court. So you don't accept
the fact that afterwards she kind of explains herself and what happened at this, and her reasons for closing it. Do you not?
Your Honor, no, I don't. Mm-hmm. She says she was concerned about attorney-client privilege and some other matters and the dispute between counsel and the appellant, standby counsel and the appellant, but she doesn't do anything more than that. She never goes through why she thought this was the least, restrictive alternative available to her. She had other options. She never explored those other options. She never makes a real
clear. Could you expand on that? What other options were available to her?
Well, first she should have conducted a mini hearing to say, okay, do we have to close the court here? I'm very concerned that we're getting into matters that we shouldn't be getting into, and you may be divulging some attorney-client privilege material. She could have done that. There's, of course, a problem with that also, because he had already waived his privilege. He had already made a voluntary waiver of that privilege, of those materials. So that was inappropriate to begin with. But she could have at least slowed down and said, what are we doing here? What is your position, Major Hassan? He gave us his position. He objected to closure. He wanted to do this in open court.
Mr. Pardo, didn't the judge ask him if he would submit some of this information in writing and ex parte, and he declined to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. So
why wasn't that an alternative? I mean, she offered an alternative prior to closure.
That was one alternative, but she didn't explore other alternatives. And she didn't define what the problem was, because he had already said, Your Honor, I'm waiving. I waive my privilege. He was more interested in getting to the nub of the issue here, which was his attorneys interfering with his case and calling him crazy, than he was interested in the attorney-client privilege. So he wanted to waive so he could, in open court, essentially litigate the withdrawal motion, because that's essentially what she did here, in open court. And the military judge just closed the court and went immediately to the session that was closed.
So based on that, when he asked for this to be conducted, quote-unquote, in camera, your feeling is that after that point, more information came up that caused him to want to proceed publicly?
Yes, Your Honor, and that more information was exactly the fact that he was concerned that his counsel were claiming that he was, first of all, crazy and wanted to die. And in the closed session, he explains, that's not at all true. I want them to essentially cut it out. I want my standby counsel to be standby counsel, but not to interfere in my case. The appellant was entitled to a fair trial, and to ensure a fair trial, that trial has to be public.
So in any case where a portion of a trial is not public, is it per se unfair?
If there are no, pursuant to Waller, yes, Your Honor. If there are no Waller analysis, the military judge doesn't look at the Waller factors, doesn't evaluate analyze the factors and the other routes that she can take to satisfy whatever the problem is, unless, of course, we have the statutory closure, which you still have to make that finding in those circumstances as well. She didn't do any of that. This case was a total closure as well. The government says this was just a partial closure. But as this court said in Ortiz, you look to the participants in the court. And by removing all the spectators, this no longer was a public trial. It was a closed trial. It was totally closed. Even if it was closed only for the attorney-client matters that she later described as being the reason she closed the court, the matters discussed in that closed hearing went far beyond any privilege. She could have closed the court, said, Major Hassan, I'm concerned about attorney-client privilege. It's not clear to me that you've waived. He said, once again, during the closed session, I have waived. I don't have any interest in that anymore. Then she could have come right back on the record, described what was discussed in that closed session, and moved on. Instead, they talked about the reasons why she's denying the withdrawal motion and discussed the client's concerns with the matters that were being raised by his standby counsel.
One of the impressions that I got from that exchange, you know, was almost sometimes like two people passing in the night. The judge is saying one thing, and the accused was saying something else. And so in that regard, then, as I'm looking down at this footnote, that when the judge says, you know, asked him specifically about waiving privileges, and he says yes, and then she starts going through what she thinks he's waiving, and he ultimately says no, I'm not waiving that. So again, because there was no clear and concise, almost definition of what the accused was waiving, you're arguing that the judge should not have erred in the side of caution to ensure that attorney-client information was not discussed in open court? I mean, that's what I'm getting from you. Am I interpreting your argument incorrectly?
No, Your Honor. You err on the side of openness. Make the Waller findings. Because they were not discussing any of that material in open court. She was just trying to discern what he was waiving or not waiving. So she could have closed the court for that purpose alone. But first of all, do the Waller analysis. Get the position of the government on what, you know, their position is, and then make the appropriate findings, narrow the alternatives, and do the analysis on the record. Close the court for that purpose alone. That purpose alone. Then go right back on the record. Instead, it was hearing creep. She started moving into other matters related to his complaints about his counsel, which were matters that should have been part of the public record. The government also argues that the First Circuit case named Gottsfeld is the appropriate analysis here. We find, first of all, this court should reject Gottsfeld's analysis. We find NBC more persuasive. A few more things about Gottsfeld. Gottsfeld was before trial. This was in the middle of trial, after the panel members had been seated. Gottsfeld was a complaint by Gottsfeld's attorney against Gottsfeld. Gottsfeld and his wife were defaming that attorney via Twitter and some other multimedia. That's why the court found it was a collateral issue. Gottsfeld's attorney was asking to withdraw as a way to stop them from defaming him publicly. And one other interesting side note that I'd be happy to supplementally cite, though it's not in the opinion, Gottsfeld's wife was at that hearing. So it was only a partial closure. In this case, the
appellant... I would say before you move on, so what you're saying is you're distinguishing Gottsfeld to say that the issue with regards to the appellant was not a collateral issue.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor. If the appellant, for example, would have said, I want a mistrial, I want to fire my standby counsel, this case would have ground to a halt, or the military judge would have had to make decisions either denying the mistrial or denying the withdrawal of standby counsel or other decisions. So Gottsfeld, it didn't matter. The judge says, this is pretrial. You're not going to be dismissed no matter what. And it was really a cut-it-out hearing for Gottsfeld to stop defaming the attorney. This is totally different. This goes to the very heart of the appellant's case. Appellant's case was dominated in part by his relationship with his counsel and his desire to go pro se. So everything that happened in that hearing needed to be heard by the public.
So what then is the appropriate remedy? In Waller, the Supreme Court said, when there's been, quote, a violation of the public trial guarantee, the remedy should be appropriate to the violation.
Your Honor, since Waller, Weaver was decided by the Supreme Court, and so was Presley. And Weaver says this is a structural error because it goes to the heart of the public and the accused's case. The ability to measure the prejudice here is really impossible. So they said in Weaver, if the appellant objects, and there's an improper closure, then the only relief is a retrial. It's because that error is structural in nature.
So Weaver overruled the approach that the Supreme Court took in terms of remedy in Waller.
Yes, Your Honor. It appears it did, because in that case, Weaver was a case where it was ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and Justice Kennedy said, well, if we were looking at this from a pure error objected to a trial, this would be a structural error, and the only remedy is a retrial. So we read Weaver as overruling or at least modifying Waller.
It would seem curious that the Supreme Court would not note that fact. that they were changing the length, the one of the key elements of Waller. In Waller, Supreme Court goes on to say that really warned against imposing a remedy that, quote, would be a windfall for the defendant and not the public interest. Why then, in Weaver, doesn't the Supreme Court affirmatively note that they're no longer taking that approach?
They do. They don't overrule expressly Waller, but they say this is the appropriate remedy for a structural error is reversal. They also note, Justice Kennedy also notes that, you know, this is really a very well-enshrined rule. So judges know not to close courts martial. In part, that is why this is a structural error. And the other reason why it should be structural error here, Your Honor, is what other remedy really is there? The public was excluded from a hearing. That hearing was not only closed to the public, it was sealed. Sealed until that case, this case became, came before this court. So there's no other remedy available under the circumstances. It's a closure of 10 years, essentially. So the appropriate remedy here is a rehearing. And it's the only way an appellant could have received a fair trial, is for the public to be aware of what happened at his court-martial, including the fact that his standby counsel were interfering with his case. The military judge had to tell them to cut it out. So this is indeed a structural error.
Mr. Potter, let me ask a hypothetical. What if you have a similar situation and what happens during the closed session benefits the accused? Can he or should he later claim that for all the reasons that you just explained that he ought to get a new trial, even though what happened during the closed session, what decisions made during the closed sessions, all benefited him?
Your Honor, that's...
Does it matter?
Really, as an intellectual matter, it doesn't matter. And in fact, during the arguments on Waller, one of the questions from the court was exactly that. And the attorney there will say the same thing I'm going to say here. Well, we wouldn't be here now if it actually benefited my client to the extent that he wasn't convicted. So that may be the answer to that question, but it's still a violation of the public right to a trial, no matter what the result of the hearing. If the appellant in this case could have derailed his case and the public would have known nothing about that, and then the military judge seals that record, and it's sealed for years and years and years, that was a structural error. The military judge also committed error in allowing a biased panel member to sit. We believe Lieutenant Bias is established by many answers in his questionnaires and during voir dire, but I'm going to focus on the answers to questions 222, 30, and 192. I start with 222 because it establishes Lieutenant should not have sat pursuant to 912 Foxtrot 1 Mike. He had a definite opinion about the guilt or innocence of the appellant. He has asked the question whether, as a result of the questionnaire, he formed any opinion about guilt or punishment. He answers, and I'm quoting, "No, I had an opinion already." That's a JA2434. That opinion was cemented by his vast knowledge of the case, not only from his reading about the case, but talking to people from Fort Hood. And as he said in that questionnaire, it would take pages and pages and pages to capture his knowledge of the case. But he was less than candid about having that opinion. In JA561, "Do you hold an opinion based on that bumper sticker or any other reason that would preclude you from following the evidence?" He says no. But he already had an opinion about the case. He said so in his questionnaire. In question 30, which is at JA2395, he has served on a prior court-martial. He believed the soldier who was receiving an Article 15 turned down the Article 15 and then went to trial was being contemptuous for demanding a trial. Contemptuous. He also added, in his view, it was, quote, a real waste of senior leader time. So here's a panel member who not only already has an opinion about the case, but he has an opinion about the military justice system that fits into the rubric of Woods, which he cannot accept. The system as it is, he has a different view, a skewed opinion about military justice.
Counsel, in light of all these issues, why was there no objection?
There was no objection, Your Honor. We acknowledge that.
You just spent several minutes explaining to us why he was a terrible panel member. But then the appellant was asked if he had any objection, and he said no. And then he was asked, are you waiving any objection to the participation as panel member? And he said yes. So what do we do with that?
Your Honor, we think it should be analyzed under plain error. The precedent is Strand and Mack.
Well, doesn't plain error apply when there is no waiver, no express waiver? If there is an express waiver, we don't get into plain error, do we? Because there's no error.
No, Your Honor, but the Army Court didn't find an affirmative waiver here. That's an important factor. And as the Chief Judge, as you have written, waiver is serious business.
It is serious business, I agree, but nonetheless, someone can waive, and that's why express waivers are preferred as opposed to these implied waivers or operational law waivers.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But they have, in this case, a very express waiver. I mean, the judge is trying to, other than stomp his feet and wink his eye, to tell the accused that this is someone who poses a problem with respect to being a member in the case, and the accused wants this individual to remain.
Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. The judge just asked if, you know, you object to this member. What she should have done.
Can I just address that? What the military judge said is, quote, are you specifically waiving any challenges for cause of the remaining members?
Yes, Your Honor, he did say that. So what we think is important is the nature of the right that is at stake defines the waiver, as Alano and a lot of this Court's opinions say. And the nature of the right here is a fair and unbiased panel. And it wasn't only the appellant that had responsibilities in this case. The government had a responsibility pursuant to 912 Foxtrot 1 to list any grounds of challenge for a prospective panel member. The government was aware of the answer on question 222, as was the appellant and perhaps even the military judge. The military judge should have been aware of the answer on question 222 because of the unique situation with this panel member.
You're not saying that the military judge has a duty or obligation to remove a member for cause when the accused has expressly waived his challenge for cause. Are you saying that?
Your Honor, I'm saying that the military judge has the duty to make sure that appellant is being tried by an impartial panel. If she suspects somebody or has knowledge that somebody should be excused because he has a bias, and that bias was exhibited throughout the questionnaire but also question 222 and by his redo of the questionnaire where he says, I chose to redo this questionnaire when I first filled it out 9 months ago. I was in the throes of battalion command and had a darker view of issues.
I remember what he said, but again, in the face of an express waiver, you're saying the military judge had a sua sponte duty in this case to reject the waiver put forward and on the record by the accused.
Yes, Your Honor, especially okay. Considering the factors at play in this one panel member.
Where does that duty come from?
Go ahead.
Where does that duty come from? Because I think the applicable provision of the rules for court-martial say may. So how do we get from the military judge may excuse a potential panel member to the military judge must?
Because if he falls squarely under 912F1, which says he had to be removed because he had already expressed an opinion about this case.
Had he been challenged? There was no challenge.
There was no challenge, but it's a shall be removed is the operative language there. So a military judge has a duty to make sure the appellant isn't tried by a biased panel.
Is it only because this accused was proceeding pro se, and would it be a different rule or a different view if he were actively represented by detailed counsel?
No, Your Honor. It may be a consideration, but if you look to Strand and to Mack and even Akbar, in Akbar, it was the decided strategy of those trial defense counsel to stack the panel with as many members as they could. And still this court did the analysis. So Strand, Akbar, Mack are still good law. There's still a duty to make sure that there is not a biased panel member on the panel. It destroys military justice.
But to that end, in the individual voir dire, on three different occasions, he reiterated that he could listen to the evidence, that he would abide by the instructions of the military judge, that he was specifically asked, if you don't hold an opinion based on, and this is on the bumper sticker question, but it was three different iterations of it, you don't hold an opinion based upon that bumper sticker or any other reason you may have an opinion. And so on three different occasions, he's answered a version of that question that would include any other opinion. So why did that not rehabilitate the witness to the extent that the military judge would assume that they no longer were biased and had to be removed under 912F1?
Your Honor, because of the shared responsibilities here, the government was aware of the questionnaire and that expression of opinions about putting himself in the place of the victims, the 222 question, the rest of his answers in that questionnaire, all of which put together as a very disqualified member. She was aware of that. The government was aware of the problems with this panel member. They read the questionnaires as well. They had a duty to inform the military judge, hey, he has expressed an opinion about this case.
Wasn't the accused also aware of it? I mean, when the accused actively was involved in voir dire, and even with, when he starts questioning, he says, going back to the questionnaire that you filled out. So, in the record alone, it's clear that the appellant had the questionnaire in front of him also. So I must assume he was also aware of these problems but chose not to challenge this member.
Your Honor, we have to presume he was aware, but still the military judge has a duty as well, and so does the government. And the military judge should have been aware of the questionnaire because the panel member spotlighted it. And secondly, the government was surely aware of the questionnaire, and he had expressed an opinion, and they had a duty to spotlight it to the military judge.
What if the accused has a theory that fits, that it can be accommodated by having, as bizarre as it might be, or unwise as it might be, but what if the accused, not in this case, I'm not suggesting that at all, but what if an accused has a bizarre theory that can be accommodated in his or her mind by having a member like this on the panel and is actively and adamantly protesting to the judge, I want this member on the panel. Is the judge still supposed to exercise the duty you say he has to remove the member nonetheless?
A couple of answers to that, Your Honor. First of all,
let's assume that the accused is, like here, is proceeding pro se, fully competent, inquiry has been made, and the judge is satisfied that the accused can proceed competently pro se.
I think the operative word there is the inquiry has been made, not just do you want this panel member. Do you realize, okay, let's go through this panel member, the problems. Let's go back to what happened.
Well, I don't know if he has that obligation. Does the judge have that obligation? When I said an inquiry, I meant the inquiry onto the competence of the accused to proceed pro se to begin with.
Under the particular circumstances in this case, where the panel member has informed the court that he chose to redo his questionnaire because he was in a dark place, and under those circumstances, both the government and the military judge should also look with a spotlight on this panel member. In my experience, I've never seen a redo of a questionnaire. Never seen a panel member do that. And what is a darker place? We have no idea to this day what a darker place was. But it's clear from his questionnaires that
please proceed.
Clear from his questionnaires that it was not a favorable view of the appellant, and he already had an opinion about the guilt of the appellant.
So in a situation like this, what is the standard of review that this court should impose in determining whether the military judge properly exercised her sua sponte responsibility?
Plain error, Your Honor. And looking to, in this case, the circumstances would be, the plain error would be because the redo of the questionnaire, she would, because she received that in a motion, any reasonable military judge would have looked to say, darker place, this is strange, looked at that questionnaire, and then done some voir dire regarding the darker place that this panel member was in and why he chose to redo his questionnaire.
So you're not, let me go back to an earlier question. I'm sorry, Chief.
No, please proceed.
Please indulge me. Let me go back a minute from what you and I talked about in this case, and that is, you're not now, I think I understand, you're not now claiming that the error was, that you want us to review for plain error in light of the waiver. You're saying the actual error was the inability or unwillingness or failure of the military judge to further inquire about why the accused might want this member on?
And that's part of it, Your Honor.
Would the accused be required to disclose that? What if that's a theory of his case?
No, Your Honor, he would be required to disclose that, but she should have said, look, this is a unique circumstance, especially in a capital case. This is a unique circumstance. We have a panel member who has submitted a redo of his questionnaire. He was in a dark place when he completed the first one. And I've looked at the questionnaire. He's already expressed an opinion about guilt. Do you understand that? That may be a valid waiver. My further response is...
So now your position is that this is not a valid waiver because of the failure to further inquire.
Yes, Your Honor. Furthermore,
right,
that the military judge, under these circumstances, has a sua sponte duty to remove this member.
More questions from the bench? Seeing none, Mr. Potter, thank you. Captain Evans?
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, good morning. May it please the court. In my comments this morning, I'm actually going to take the issues in the reverse of appellant's counsel, and I'll start first with the panel member issue and then move on to the court closure issue. Appellant's argument that the military judge erred by not sua sponte fails for at least three reasons. First, appellant waived any challenge. Second, the military judge had no duty to sua sponte excuse or any other panel member. And third, even if she did have some duty, her decision not to excuse was not plain error. Addressing waiver first, appellant waived any challenge three separate times. As the court noticed, he did so explicitly in court. When asked, are you specifically waiving any challenges for the remaining members, he said, yes, ma'am. If waiver is to have any meaning at all, it has to include situations such as that. In addition to his express waiver, he also waived the challenge by failing to raise it at trial. In the plain language of RCM 912F4 and this court's precedent, supports finding waiver in this situation.
What about Mr. Potter's position that this is not a valid waiver because they're, given the circumstances here, there needed to be further inquiry, and the judge should have inquired more about the nature of the background of this particular member before accepting the waiver?
I think that would require a vast expansion of the jurisprudence on waiver. There simply is no authority that waiving a challenge to a panel member requires some sort of heightened inquiry. And to your concerns, Judge, it would require asking questions about, hey, why are you not waiving this person? What is your strategy? What are you thinking with this
person? Should the rules be different regarding a pro se appellant or pro se defendant as opposed to one who is represented by detailed counsel?
Captain Emmons, before you respond, could you either move closer to the microphone or move the microphone closer to you? Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. No, Your Honor, the rules shouldn't be different for pro se counsel. They're expected to act as an attorney would, and that's why they can't raise IAC claims when you act pro se. And there's, to your point, Your Honor, there is no history of asking the accused himself, hey, your attorney just ostensibly waived a challenge to this member, but I want to talk to you personally and ask and make sure that you're actually waiving it and it's not just him.
No, I understand, but Mr. Potter's, one of his points is that this is a unique situation. This is a unique case. And so does that matter? Does it matter that this is a unique case with a defendant who is proceeding pro se and might be making decisions that are maybe even be unwise to an objective observer, as long as he or she understands that it is his or her decision?
No, Your Honor. Each case certainly is unique, but nothing about this case rises to that level. There's a reason why in the Feretta inquiry, an accused going pro se is warned this might be a bad decision. And it's specifically for reasons like this, where he may be waiving a challenge. But there is no requirement or no need to apply different set of rules to a pro se counsel than you would, or a pro se accused than you would to counsel. By operation of law under RCM 912, appellant waived the challenge for cause simply by not raising it. And certainly appellant has pointed to a few cases that may suggest that plain error is appropriate standard even when a challenge isn't raised at trial. But the plain language of the rule itself, it uses the term waiver. There's not the caveat of in the absence of plain error like you see elsewhere in the RCMs. And the precedent prior to Banworth appears to be the first case where this plain error even comes up. But the prior precedent of the court, which is Beard, Deitch, and Wolf, and those are CMA cases, they discuss waiver, they talk about waiver, and they apply waiver and find that waiver is the appropriate standard. Contrast that with these kind of intermediate cases of Strand, where there is no discussion of the appropriate standard. It's not central to the ruling. And if the court meant to depart from its prior precedent, then certainly it would have done some analysis in the opinion as to why plain error rather than waiver is the appropriate standard.
So just to be clear, are you saying that these other aspects of the accused at that time not raising the issue constituting waiver, are you saying that all that needs to be considered to determine there was waiver, or can the mere fact that the military judge asked him, standing alone, do you specifically waive this, is that sufficient?
Yes, Your Honor, the latter. So our position is that he waived in three separate and distinct manners. The first way was expressly on the record answering the military judge's question. The second way was by operation of law by not raising it. And then the third and separate way that he waived it was by not exercising his peremptory challenge. Appellant had the opportunity, if he wanted Lieutenant Colonel Garwald not to sit on his panel, to exercise his peremptory challenge, and he chose instead, as is his right, not to exercise any peremptory challenge. And this court and the service courts have consistently held that failure to exercise a peremptory challenge at all waives those challenges for cause. Now, the rule says that if you raise the challenge for cause first and then don't use your peremptory, then it's waived, and the rule is very explicit that it waives any further review on appeal. But certainly an accused that doesn't take the first step of giving the military judge the opportunity to excuse the panel member can't be in a better position, and so that waiver provision must apply in the absence of an initial challenge for cause as well. Even if appellant didn't waive any challenge, as the plain language of the RCM and as this court has made clear, the military judge had no duty to sua sponte excuse. The rule uses the word may. The court in McFadden analyzed that word may, analyzed the use of the word may, and said, hey, may means discretion. And that was an appropriate reading of the plain language of the RCM. And the court also reaffirmed that in Akbar. It said the military judge has no duty, but even if there is a duty, in the alternative, we'll still go through the factors. But it reaffirmed what's central to McFadden, that there is no duty to excuse a panel member.
And so in a hypothetical situation, if there's a potential panel member who says, I've already made up my mind, the accused is guilty, there's nothing you can do that will change my mind, I'm not going to listen to the instructions, you're saying that a military judge can choose not to exercise his or her sua sponte responsibility, and this court or the CCA can do nothing about it. Essentially, it's non-reviewable.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that having no duty to sua sponte excuse a member means that the decision not to excuse a member can't be error. That you have the absolute discretion to not excuse a panel member. That's from the words of the RCM itself.
Can you think of other instances where a military judge can make trial-altering, momentous decisions and it's not reviewable by either the CCA or this court? Besides a military judge entering a not guilty verdict, can you think of any other instances?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor.
So why should we look at this and say it's not reviewable as compared to saying if it's not waived, then we look at this for an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think you start with the language of the RCM itself. The president used may for a reason. He could have used must, as he did other provisions in the RCM, but chose not to. So if there were some duty, then certainly the president could have imposed that duty, but instead chose not to.
So then the hypothetical that I've given you, where a prospective panel member says, my mind is made up, I'm not going to pay attention to any of the evidence, I'm not going to be swayed by the instruction, the CCA in this court would have to sit there and do nothing about it.
I think what's key to your hypothetical, Chief Judge, is that to get to that point, the appellant or the accused would have first had to not raise the challenge. They would have had to waive the challenge. And so, again, there may be any number of reasons why they chose to do that.
Why doesn't this failure to raise something actually result in forfeiture rather than waiver, and then we would review it?
Because of the language of the RCM, Your Honor. It uses the word waive. Elsewhere in the RCM, it says waive in the absence of plain error, and the court has interpreted that as forfeiture. But there is no caveat in this provision in the RCM. And I think the rule recognizes that,
Okay. Let's set aside the waiver issue with regards to the appellant. Going back to the point the Chief Judge was making with regards to the reviewing the discretionary decision of the military judge, that we would generally review that under abuse of discretion. I'm still not clear why you're saying we would not review that using an abuse of discretion standard.
Because, Your Honor, that supposes that there is some duty to excuse panel members in certain circumstances. So if there is no duty, the corollary is that the military judge has the absolute discretion not to do that thing. And so it's not necessarily that it's not reviewable, but the military judge can't abuse her discretion in that circumstance. But even if the court did find that the military judge has some duty, the language of the rule is not any time there's a biased panel member. It's in the interest of justice, which suggests that it's something more. And so perhaps the chief judge's hypothetical, you have a panel member saying, I refuse to listen to anything, I will only convict. Maybe that's a case where those interests of justice demand it, but certainly not on the facts of this case.
Captain Emmons, I think that Mr. Potter's position, as I understood it, and he can advise me to the contrary on rebuttal, is that the error here, the rule says may, but I think what he's saying is that the error here is an abuse of discretion and not conducting further inquiry, not necessarily the decision to retain the member on the panel. So I think in his view, or at least under the position as I understand it, is that had the military judge made further inquiry to satisfy herself that this accused wants this member, notwithstanding what an objective viewer would view as problematic background.
Even if that's true, Your Honor, that the military judge in this case did do sufficient inquiry, that the voir dire in this case was sufficient. And in addition to the questions that the military judge asked, the follow-up questions specifically to his questionnaire and to his questions in general voir dire, she permitted significant leeway to both parties in conducting voir dire. And so under these circumstances, it was sufficient inquiry to find that even if she had some duty, she didn't need to exercise that duty in this case. Even if the military judge did have some duty, her decision was not plain error. First, the military judge certainly could have considered the fact that the appellant expressly waived any challenge. And so that can go into the analysis. If she did have a duty, hey, this accused, I gave him the opportunity, he might want him, so who am I to interfere with his right in choosing the panel? Additionally, appellant in this case had a clear voir dire strategy. This wasn't a case where he was a potted plant, where it was an ineffective counsel. He was actively engaged in voir dire. He requested that certain members be called back for individual questioning. He questioned, I think, all but two of the members in individual voir dire. He asked that one panel member be recalled to question him in individual voir dire again. And he had a consistent theme throughout his questions, things that were clearly important to him in assessing a panel member. And so under the facts of this case, the military judge deferring to that strategy was certainly appropriate. The military judge, in terms of deferring the strategy, also had in her mind the possibility that the accused or the appellant was employing the so-called ace of hearts strategy, and she mentioned that twice. And so it's clear that she was considering that he had a strategy and that it had been developed at voir dire. And finally, in addition to deferring to his strategy, the military judge didn't err because there was no actual bias and no implied bias in this case. As the court knows, in the inquiry into actual bias, special deference is given to the military judge in her assessment of the responses of the potential panel members. And in this case, protestations of impartiality should have been believed, and she did believe them. Each of the putative, problematic response gave, he repudiated those in either his second questionnaire or during group and individual voir dire. And the military judge had all of those things available, got to sit there, see his demeanor during voir dire, and so her decision not to find actual bias was reasonable under these facts. And then finally, there was no implied bias. Under the totality of the circumstances in this case, a member of the public would not think that the risk that appellant received an unfair trial was too high under these cases. The totality of the circumstances necessarily includes the context of these responses, the fact that, under his own words, when he submitted his first questionnaire, he was in a darker place, and then with time to reflect, he changed those responses, which is exactly what the kind of duty that a panel member raised issues that come up later. He was executing that duty by updating. He said, these weren't accurate reflections. Here's the more accurate position. And then finally, during group voir dire, he was asked questions addressing each of those issues and answered them satisfactorily. He said that he could consider the evidence. He said that nothing about the specifics of this case, the nature of the crime, would lead him to reach a conclusion. He could consider all the evidence and would solely rule based on the evidence presented in court. Pending any questions, I'll move on to the court closure issue.
Please proceed.
The temporary closure of appellant's court martial did not deprive him of his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. First, the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial simply doesn't attach to a hearing on a motion to modify the role of standby counsel. Second, the military judge did not abuse her discretion when she temporarily closed the court. And third, even if she did err, there was no violation of the Sixth Amendment right to public trial. Now, the beginning of the inquiry here is the question of whether the Sixth Amendment right even applies to the hearing that we're talking about. And it doesn't. And in this case, really what we had was it was a motion to modify the role of standby counsel. So a person who was not a party in the case, essentially having a disagreement with the military judge as to his professional responsibility obligations. And that was the hearing that was at issue here. And the courts looked to the four interests that are protected by the right to public trial to determine whether that right actually attaches to a particular hearing. And those are that to ensure that the public sees the accused dealt with fairly, to remind the judge and prosecutor of their duty, to encourage witnesses to come forward and testify, and to discourage perjury. And when you consider all four of those factors together in light of the facts of this case and the nature of the hearing at issue, it's clear that the right just simply doesn't attach to this type of hearing. Seeing that the public...
So, are you saying that all four of those criteria have to be fulfilled? Or are you saying that, let's say, focus on the first two. Why don't those attach here?
I think those are considerations. I don't think it's a checklist. I don't think it's one is sufficient. I think those are the four interests that need to be balanced in reaching the ultimate conclusion, Your Honor.
So could you address the first two factors and why they were not of concern?
Yes, Your Honor. So first, ensuring that the public sees the accused dealt with fairly. The subjects of the conversations at issue really weren't even the appellant at all. It was what amounted to a professional responsibility issue with the standby counsel who played no active role in the trial, either at that point or for the remainder of the trial. And it was their objection to the military judge's order that they felt like they may be running afoul of their state bar rules. And so this interest in seeing the accused dealt with fairly, it just didn't exist in the same way you would in, for instance, a motion to suppress or something dealing with evidence coming in at trial.
Wouldn't the appellant's position be that I wasn't treated fairly because what was disclosed in open court painted me in a very harsh light. At the point that that was disclosed, then went into closed session, I wanted the ability to rebut or refute what had already been said. And it goes to the issue then of whether he was being treated fairly by the military judge by having the negative part be public and the clarification be private.
Your Honor, I think that to answer that question, you have to look at, first of all, this entire hearing wasn't litigated in a closed session. The military judge did her best effort to litigate this in open court. And it wasn't until it got to a certain point, based on the responses from the appellant, that she decided that she needed to close it. And so, yes, certainly the appellant may, his position may be that he was dealt with unfairly, but the nature of that hearing was really a professional responsibility issue, and the military judge trying to kind of ferret out the particulars so that she could rule on that issue. And additionally, it's important that the government was also excluded from this hearing. So, again, it wasn't a case where there may be some sort of government overreach or the government infringing on the rights of the accused. This was really a matter between the counsel and the military judge. And in the court, I believe it's in Waller, in assessing whether it attached to attached to a motion to suppress, said that it resembled a bench trial. And that's why that sort of hearing needed to be done in the open. And this simply didn't resemble a bench trial at all. If anything, this looked more like an 802 than it did any portion of the trial. And then additionally, to remind the judge and the prosecutor of their duty. Certainly the prosecutor wasn't there, so there was no duty. And the military judge needed no reminder of her duty. It's clear throughout this hearing in the matters that were litigated in open court and in the closed court that her duties were at the forefront of her mind, namely protecting the rights of the accused at that time. And then finally, the court should consider the other two factors, which simply aren't at play here, and weigh against finding that the Sixth Amendment right attaches. And we do believe that Gottesfeld is instructive. And in that case, that was a motion to withdraw counsel. And again, and the language is cited in the briefs, but the First Circuit Court in that case cited some of those same factors, specifically the fact that this doesn't look like a bench trial at all, in finding that the Sixth Amendment right didn't attach whatsoever. And here, we're even one step removed from Gottesfeld, where it's not the not the actual counsel representing the client, it's a standby counsel who ultimately played no role in the trial. And appellant cites to NBC and suggests that NBC is more persuasive and that this court should follow NBC. But NBC is certainly distinguishable from the facts of this case. There, it was an issue dealing with a conflict of interest. So certainly his right to representation, which wasn't at issue in this case, it involved government counsel. They were litigating a particular federal rule of criminal procedure, and there were procedures established for that. And the court also cited to the tradition that these types of hearing be litigated in open court. And here we certainly have no tradition, as we likewise are not aware of any cases that have dealt with this particular issue of a pro se accused.
All right. Captain Ammons, let's assume just for the moment, I'm not asking you to concede at all, but let's assume for the moment that the Sixth Amendment applies. What about appellant's assertion or complaint that the military judge didn't crank through the proper steps beforehand? In other words, before closing the court on this issue? presumably because she may not have had enough information, but her concern was such that she thought she needed to get right to the closed court session. And that, in the view of appellant, is problematic.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think there's a distinction between kind of making the determination that a closed hearing is necessary and putting findings on the record. And there's simply no requirement to put findings on the record prior to closing a hearing. In Ortiz, this court suggested that those findings could be made in an addendum to the record, which necessarily suggests it was after the fact. And the purpose of those findings is to facilitate appellate review. It's to allow this court and the service courts the opportunity to review the decision, which whether those findings are made before the closed hearing or immediately after, this court still has access to the findings to conduct its review. And so I think it's clear from the record that the military judge had made the determination that they needed to go into a closed hearing, and she in fact said so. She said, I closed the hearing because this, this, and this. And so she's then putting the findings, when she had a moment to do it, on the record.
But I think, to follow up on Judge Sparks' question, and he was reiterating the appellant's argument, that the need to go through the Waller factors before you close the hearing, before you make that determination, how do you address that? The fact that she did not go through the Waller factors prior to closing the hearing.
I'm not aware of any authority, Your Honor, that requires to put those findings on the record beforehand. I think what's important, what's key, is that the military judge makes the determination in line with the four Waller factors. And she did so in this case, and after the hearing said as much, put those findings. And so those things need to exist, certainly, before the court is closed, but the requirement to put the findings on the record just doesn't exist. And for the reasons the findings are required, it makes sense why it's okay to do it after the fact.
So I just want to be clear what your argument is there. Now, the Supreme Court talked about making these decisions before closure of the court. Are you saying that the military judge has to have made those decisions but puts them on the record later? Is that the distinction you're drawing?
I think that's what happened in this case.
No, I know that. But the Supreme Court has said to close the court, Sixth Amendment right, you got to, hey, trial judges, you need to put it on the record before you close the court while you're doing it.
Again, Your Honor, I would just turn to the purpose of those findings is for appellate review. And so whether they're done, it's possible that there could be a scenario where 9 months after the fact, the military judge says, oh, yeah, I closed that for this reason, and that's not good enough. But certainly under the facts of this case, where you get the sense that there are people talking over each other, as Your Honor said, kind of passing in the night, and it's escalating, the military judge needs to take some action. And then so she made that determination, and then after the fact went back and made the findings, then that is not problematic.
But in that approach, it prevents the parties from being able to refute any reasoning that the military judge may have for closing the court. Isn't that part of the issue here, is you do it beforehand so the military judge articulates why she is doing it, and then the parties, the accused, can say, wait a minute, you're misunderstanding something here, or pointing the military judge to the applicable case law that is extremely geared towards not closing courtrooms.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that certainly that's a consideration, and that's a benefit of doing it beforehand. But I don't think that the failure to do it beforehand then means that it's error.
But part of it then, too, is this idea of, and some of the precedents out there are, the disclosure of what occurred. In one case, it refers to within a reasonable time. Here it was more than 9 years before what happened there was disclosed publicly. Why shouldn't that give us pause?
Well, it shouldn't, Your Honor, because, first of all, the closure was reasonable under the circumstances. The military judge followed the law. And so that is the fact that the transcripts are published later is a consideration for whether it was erroneous or whether there was any prejudice caused by the closure or whether it deprived him of his rights. But here the military judge, as a starting point, her initial closure was not error. And so then the fact that the transcripts, even if they had never been released, that wouldn't be a problem because the closure was permissible under these circumstances. But it does cut against a finding that there was any deprivation of a right in this case, even if the military judge erred, shouldn't have closed the court, then the production of the transcripts after the fact cuts against any deprivation of the right to public trial.
Doesn't this court have a broader concern in terms of creating precedents that could be at a minimum mischievous? In terms of, you seem to be saying, listen, military judge can totally close a courtroom and then afterwards put on the record why. You're now saying the public may not be able to see at any point what happened there. That's what you want us to write in an opinion. That's the precedence you want this court to set when it comes to Sixth Amendment right to a public trial.
I think you have to take it each step of the analysis, Your Honor. And so first, it's an abuse of discretion as to whether it was error to close the court. And so it's going to depend on the particular facts of the case. And not every case is going to be like this case. And there's, as we've discussed, there are very unique circumstances here, including the fact that it's an accused, a pro se accused. And the military judge is doing everything she can to kind of protect his rights and ensure that those aren't prejudiced. And then the decision, you have to analyze the actual decision to close the court and does it meet those Waller factors? And in this case, it does, and we can walk through those. But the military judge's, that decision was not erroneous. And so because it wasn't erroneous, then the publication of the transcript after the fact is kind of a separate issue. If the closure isn't erroneous, there's no requirement to publish a transcript after the fact. That would defeat the purpose of the closure. And so really the time of the publication of the transcript after the fact is a consideration in doing that analysis of was the closure proper, and if not, did it violate his right to a public trial, if that answers your Honor's question. And in this case, the military judge, walking through the Waller factors quickly, her decision certainly was not an abuse of discretion. The overriding interest in this case was protecting those privileged communications for the sake of the attorney-client privilege itself and to ensure that those didn't somehow find their way into the jury box and prejudice the accused. The closure was not broader than necessary. It was a very short period of time. Again, the military judge attempted to litigate it in open court, and only when she got to the point where she felt like she needed to go into the closed session did she. And it was only for that very narrow issue. And then once that was resolved, everything else was done in the open. The military judge did consider reasonable alternatives. To Your Honor's point, she requested, hey, can you submit something ex parte? I'm trying to protect your rights. I want this in writing. I want to do it a different way. And then again, the biggest alternative was she attempted to litigate this issue in open court. It wasn't a scenario where the military judge went on the record and immediately said, hey, everybody out of here. I got this motion, and we're going to deal with it. It was, let's talk through this. I want to do this. Reminder, don't talk about privilege. Let's go. And then only when it got to that point did she find it necessary to close the court.
How does RCM 806 play into our analysis?
806, Your Honor, it codifies the Sixth Amendment right to a public jury trial. So our starting position would be that if the Sixth Amendment right doesn't attach, which our position is that it doesn't, that 806 should kind of yield to that Sixth Amendment. It should be in line because it's protecting the same interest.
Well, how do you get there, though? Because 806 says, quote, courts martial shall be open to the public, end quote. And then RCM 103.8b refers to Article 39A sessions as being part of a courts martial. So Article 39A would be covered by the mandate that they shall be open.
Yes, Your Honor. And so that's kind of the starting point, is that we think the rule should be read in line with the interest that it's meant to protect, which is the Sixth Amendment. But then, even if RCM 806 applies in a situation where the Sixth Amendment applies, under these facts, again, there is no error because the military judge didn't violate the RCM. So he walked through the analysis. It's satisfied. There's no issue. But then kind of the next step is where, even if you found some error in RCM 806, I think that's where it's subject to a harmlessness analysis. And so the court would then look back to the Sixth Amendment, the right that it's trying to protect, and say, well, in this case, there was no Sixth Amendment right, so even if RCM 806 attaches, and even if there was a violation of RCM 806, there's no prejudice because the right to a public trial was not violated. And finally, and relatedly, even if there was some error, appellant was simply not denied his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. This court has said that even if there's error, that the error doesn't necessarily mean a deprivation of that Sixth Amendment right, and you have to look to the facts of the particular case to make that determination. And in this case, it was a very ancillary issue. The closure was very brief, and again, the transcript has since been released. And pending any further questions.
More questions from the bench?
This court should affirm the Army Corps. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Emmons. Mr. Potter.
We simply disagree with the government's approach on the court closure. You make the Waller findings before you close. Why is that? Because the interest at stake. Of course, there's the interest of the accused, but there's also the interest of the press and other bodies and the public. So you make that determination first before you close. So an aggrieved party can go to court to say, hey, I want to be in that hearing.
Counsel, did we misspeak then in Ortiz when we suggested that those could be added to the record later in an addendum?
Your Honor, I read Ortiz to mean that if there is indeed an improper closure, it may be saved after the fact by finding some things that
maybe I'm misremembering it, but I thought we specifically said that the findings supporting the closure could be added to the record in an amendment later. Doesn't that necessarily imply that they're not announced before the closure?
Your Honor, I think Waller says you have to do it in the proper order. If you do, like the judge did in Ortiz, you can look back and perhaps tease out the proper reason for the hearing, the alternatives looked at, all of those things. But remember in Ortiz, the judge didn't do that. She had a clear reason, according to this court, to close the court. There was reasons in the record, but she didn't announce those reasons. She didn't make those findings. And this court found that to be a Sixth Amendment violation. And it's also important to remember that all of these cases, the foundation for them isn't in the Sixth Amendment. It's in the First Amendment, where the press enterprises, in those cases, where the press seeks to be part of a hearing and to attend a hearing. To have a hearing and have it already over and then say, oh, okay, there's an aggrieved party here who couldn't attend the proceeding, that just doesn't work. That doesn't secure the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial or the First Amendment right to attend that public trial.
If we agree with you and we write an opinion that way, do we need to correct our mistake in Ortiz? Do we need to say that this has to be done? The decision, the Waller factors have to be analyzed before the closure, and the findings have to be put on the record. And therefore, to the extent we suggested otherwise in Ortiz, that was an error.
Your Honor, I don't read Ortiz quite the same way. I think Ortiz is there was a mistake made, and it's clear from the record why it should have been closed, but there weren't the appropriate findings. So, and in this case, there weren't the appropriate findings either. That is our position, that there's no way this can be fixed, because the military judge said merely, I close for attorney-client privilege and other reasons, and the substance of the hearing was not permissible for non-public trial. Those were matters of ethics, and we believe NBC is much more persuasive than Gottsfeld on that issue.
What about the government's point that this is essentially a third party? The standby counsel had not participated up to that point, and they never participated in the trial. So what this was a matter between attorneys who had no role in the trial and the military judge about their concerns about their ethical responsibilities.
The public following this case would say, no, that's not the case at all. One of the centerpieces of this entire trial was appellant's relationship with his counsel and then his standby counsel. And what was discussed in that hearing wasn't just nothing of any importance. It was whether he wanted to retain that standby counsel, whether there were going to be sanctions against the standby counsel, and what was the remedy for the standby counsel turning over appellant's entire file to the government. That was the essence of that hearing. And if the appellant would have chosen some other avenues, asked for different relief, it would have blown up this trial. And that's why it's the essence of a public trial right. That matter was of public interest.
What if the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply, as the government's position asserts? Is your position that it doesn't matter because the rules for our courts-martial are designed to vindicate both the Sixth and the First Amendment?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so 806 would take – it falls under the umbrella of 806. And we think if it falls under the umbrella of 806, it carries with it the same remedy as Weaver carries with it, which is this is a right that is not only in possession of the appellant, but also in possession of the public. They have a right to be in that hearing. And the only way to vindicate this right is by a rehearing, a retrial in this case.
So you're saying that both constitutional amendments are designed to be vindicated through the court-martial process, but are the remedies necessarily the same?
We think because of the way you read Weaver and the for lack of a the mishmash of interests at stake and the absolute difficulty in determining prejudice to the parties involved, that a structural error is appropriate. But there's another reason that is fundamentally appropriate to provide a severe remedy in this case is not only what the military judge did by closing the court, but she essentially kept that court closed for 9 years. She sealed that material, and then the Army Court vindicated that decision by keeping it closed for as well. And the appellant was unable to vindicate his rights until this court allowed us to see those materials. So it's had a direct impact on our representation by her decision to close the court, and she never summarized what happened in that court, and we were unaware of the actual impact that had on our case. Judge Sparks, you asked if the remedy that we're seeking is to is a vast expansion of this court's jurisprudence regarding waiver and forfeiture and panel member selection. No, we're asking for a very specific rule. And this, if something as odd as this happens at a court-martial, especially in a capital case where the death penalty is on the table, that a panel member says, hey, I want to redo my questionnaire, and that first questionnaire has matters that would disqualify him, that the military judge has more of a duty to look into that panel member. Secondly, the government cited the second questionnaire here as somehow vindicating the military judge's decision in this case. There is no indication she or anybody else considered that second questionnaire during voir dire. It is not in the packet of voir dire material. It's attached to the motion. And from all indications are they just used the first questionnaire. So no way does that second questionnaire rehabilitate Lieutenant Colonel Garwal. So the matters in that first questionnaire are what the military judge had before her, and she had the signal that there was a problem with that questionnaire because he was in a very dark place and she did nothing. The government had the signal as well, and they did nothing.
Counsel, if the appellant says he doesn't want to waive a panel member and then the military judge later comes in and decides to excuse them, is there a potential problem that might not respect the wishes of the defendant? They might have wanted that person for some other unrelated reason.
Your Honor, that would be case by case. If she would have gone through that analysis, you know, and said, hey, I've got this panel member who has submitted this questionnaire that says I have an opinion already, that is, per the rules, shall be disqualified from this court-martial, then...
Well, then what does the word may mean? In the specific provision in the rules that talks about the military judge's authority, it says the military judge may. So what is that? Is that may just a bad drafting by the president?
Your Honor, I think this court is well aware of the waiver forfeiture difficulties throughout the manual and has addressed that. We believe that forfeiture is the appropriate rule because of the interest at stake. It's not only his interest to choose who he wants to serve on the court-martial. It's also the interest to have a court-martial system that we can depend on. And having a panel member like Lieutenant Colonel Garwald on the panel, that's not a system we can depend on.
Chief Judge, I know the time is running.
Please, Judge Sparks.
The last question. I want to be sure, Mr. Potter, I understand your position on waiver here. Is it your view that the problem here is an abuse of discretion on the part of the military judge to ensure that the waiver was knowing? Now, all what waivers in most legal contexts must be voluntary and knowing. So is the problem here, because I think I hear you saying that the judge should have done more to ensure that the accused was making a knowing waiver as opposed to just waiving, express or otherwise.
Yes, Your Honor, and with another caveat, and demonstrating that on the record.
Because you agree with me that if that's the case, that's the only way you get to have us get to plain error review. Because if the waiver is valid, I think you would agree with me that the first question under plain error review is what? Is there an error?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if a waiver is valid, then there's no error, is there?
That's correct, Your Honor, but we have to look at the interests of everybody at stake and the responsibilities of everybody at stake in this situation, which is military judge has a responsibility to not seat a biased panel member. The government...
But no, I understand what you're saying. All of these things add up, but I just want to make sure that you and I are on the same wavelength here for the moment, at least.
Yes, Your Honor, we'll see.
At least for the moment, that the issue is the knowing or the knowledge of the accused that he is making a knowing waiver. And you think the military judge should have done more. The government says they did enough. She did enough. But you think the military judge should have done more to ensure, made a further inquiry, to ensure that the accused is making a knowing waiver to not challenge this member.
Under these circumstances, yes, with this panel member.
Well, yes, part of the circumstances, didn't the appellant have a government-funded voir dire expert?
Yes, Your Honor.
And despite that, and the government-funded voir dire expert had access to the questionnaires, and the appellant did not choose to use challenge for cause, peremptory challenge, and when asked by the military judge about the waiver, wait.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the government also had those questionnaires, and the military judge should have known what was in that questionnaire because of the circumstances.
I want to circle back because I'm going to do Judge Sparks now because maybe when you just answered Judge Sparks, I was like, was that what he was arguing before? Because with regards to the abuse of discretion, you said that the military judge should have done more to ensure that the waiver was knowing. And then you said, and documented on the record. She asked him twice. I mean, she asked him individually, and then she circles back and says, so you have the specific request with regards to Lieutenant Colonel Garwal, and then she circles back later and says, okay, once again, do you have challenges to any of these panel members? So I guess I'm not understanding the how you see that she did not ensure that the waiver was knowing. What more did you want her to do?
Because of the special circumstances of this panel member and the fact this is essence, the very essence of a fair trial is an unbiased panel, and how it's nested in the Sixth Amendment where there's other rights, Faretta rights and other rights, where there's more inquiry needed. To plead guilty, there's more inquiry needed. There should have been more inquiry here under the special circumstances where a panel member said, I had to redo my questionnaire. I'm in a very dark place when I did the first one. And he has answers in that questionnaire that are disqualifying. More needs to be done, specifically in a death penalty case where that one vote could be the difference between life or death verdict.
Thank you for clarifying that.
More questions from the bench? Seeing none, Mr. Barter, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.